Welcome to the Lucas Miles Show. I'm your host, Lucas Miles. Welcome to the show. I'm Lucas Miles, and you're listening to the Lucas Miles Show on the Edify Podcast Network and also a featured podcast of FaithWire.com. On today's episode, we welcome Charlie Kirk, founder of Turning Point USA and author of the new book, The MAGA Doctrine, The Only Ideas That Will Win the Future. Charlie's a controversial figure if you follow him on YouTube or Twitter. He's smart, he's young, and he is conservative. He's also gotten a lot of flack for his friendship and support of President Donald Trump, which he outlines in his new book, The MAGA Doctrine. And on this episode, Charlie and I dive into a wide range of topics from faith, philosophy, and of course, politics. You know, it's rare that I get to talk to somebody that can really hold their own in all of those conversations, and Charlie does that and more. Specifically, Charlie addresses what he calls the coming civil war of the left. We also talk about philosophers like Hegel, Darwin, and Marx, and how progressive thought has really impacted the millennial generation today, specifically the effects of issues within our educational system and some of his ideas to be able to change that. Also, Charlie opens up a little bit personally about how he deals with criticism and hate mail, and then also really what his faith means to him, which I found particularly interesting. But before we get to that interview, here's a little bit on our sponsor. This episode of the Lucas Miles Show is brought to you by Cove. Visit covesmart.com and use promo code Lucas, that's L-U-C-A-S, for all of your home security needs. And now my interview with Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk, so you have a new book called The MAGA Doctrine, The Only Ideas That Will Win the Future. And I want to talk about what ideas will win the future. But before we get to that, I'd like to really help our audience understand what's really the greatest enemy to America's future.
Well, the greatest enemy domestically is definitely the miseducation of our children, a spiritual crisis happening in our country. And we are teaching our kids to hate America when they should be taught to love America and be thankful that they live in the United States of America. And so if you have a country where generation after generation, just a little less, they appreciate where they came from, they don't appreciate where they came from, they do not love the country that they live in, then that country will cease to exist. It's actually a pretty logical equation to play out that if every generation, one after the other, is less grateful than the generation that came before them, then they will turn the table over and destroy the civilization that and this gift that we have been given. And so it's a huge problem. I mean, young people are being taught bitterness about the United States of America. They're being taught quite just absolute narratives of deceit about Western civilization. And why in very simple terms, we are living in the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. And so once we admit that education of our children and the spiritual crisis that is paired with it is the greatest threat to America, then we can actually address it and solve it, which is something that I try to do every single day.
Love it. I couldn't agree more. I was actually talking to a guy earlier today who was grew up in the UK in a Muslim family, would consider himself radicalized in the UK, and ended up finding Jesus and is now, you know, using his life to talk to people about that. And I told him, I said, I understand to some degree his story and some of the hate that he grew up with. But what confuses, I think, a lot of people, especially on the right, is when we see people on the left who oftentimes are white, middle-class, suburban kids that grow up hating the country that they live in. Where is that coming from?
Well, part of it's the educational system. Part of it is the mass media that has been educated in the education system, and they keep these awful ideas and then propagandize the public with them. Part of it is the destruction of the Western nuclear family. 77% of black kids grow up without a stable father in the home, which is one of the key reasons as to why you have permanent poverty in our country. And when you don't have a stable family at home, it's a lot harder to be able to just have very basic things such as rising incomes, be able to educate your children properly. It's hard when this is a single parent. And there's actually something to be said about having two-parent households reestablished in our country. And so there's a lot of reasons for it. It's also very tempting and very exciting for some people that have not been taught the future of our country to tear everything down around you. It's very alluring to a generation that has lots of energy, very little prospects, very little wealth that has been created, to believe that everything around them has been a mistake. In fact, it is almost indulging in hubris and in cockiness that everyone made mistakes before you, but you have all the answers. And this is basically what is the modus operandi or the mission statement of a lot of the BLM Incorporated and the activists around us. They have no sort of gratitude or appreciation for the thousands of years of literature or history that predated them. Instead, it's, well, we're the smartest people ever to exist. We're going to get it right and you're going to get it wrong. And since we're so smart, we should destroy everything that came before us. And of course, that is pathological in nature. And you kind of see the result of that. In fact, we have created a pretty incredible society here in the West. And we're doing a remarkable job of destroying it through our own, not through foreign influences. It will be one of the first times that a civilization actually crumbles. I mean, and Rome went through a similar cycle, but it wasn't even close to being as ethical or as moral of a civilization as America, where it's not a foreign enemy that is going to overtake us. It'll be civilizational suicide if we do fall.
You know, first of all, I love your passion for history. I share that, you know, one, and I think that that's part of the problem is a lot of people just don't take the time to learn about the past and these things. You know, one of the things that I say a lot is that, you know, you see within whether it's Darwinianism and then later in Marxism, this idea of that basically that it's progress that brings perfection. And we have this temptation to think that if we just go a little further each time, and so gender needs to be pushed a little further, and sexuality needs to be pushed a little bit further, and politics need to be pushed a little bit further. And eventually, you know, eventually there's a cliff that you run over, and, you know, it leads to this demise that you're talking about.
I want to comment first what you said, which was very insightful, that this is rooted in one of the last systematic thinkers, Hegel, who had the Hegelian dialectic, which is a belief that you must always have this forward progress, this march towards progress. And he didn't call it that, but he basically had the splintering of history. And it was everything was in a dialectic or a form of moving forward towards eventually what would be better. And this is really against the teachings of the Bible, if you kind of go through any sort of eschatological or theological belief of the existence of man. That put aside, if we actually understand what the left operates, they believe that progress, which actually might be one of the worst things you could do, is much better than preservation. When of course sometimes you need to right wrongs. We don't deny that. I think the Civil Rights Act was a great idea. I think the abolishing of slavery was a very good idea. However, progress at all time, at every single front, in every industry, every single facet, is actually a really bad idea. Saying that, well, the family is a mistake. No, actually, the family is one of the few things that kept people to have lived quiet and peaceful lives, as it says in 1 Timothy. So this idea that you must always have this forward march to destroy the institutions that you're currently in is one of the most cancerous and destructive and malevolent ideas that we're living through. Do we live in a two-party system? I mean, generally, yes, and not really. I mean, these are kind of more just sports jerseys that we wear. The best analogy that I could use is that it's the team analogy. There's team right and team left. And a lot of people on team right actually disagree with other people on team right. They just have basic general consensus that they have to wear the jersey to be on team right. It's not that they have tons of disagreements, but there's more fault lines than you might actually believe. For example, not everyone on team right has the same sort of economic policy, or the same sort of belief in government, but they generally believe on the same things on guns and abortion and religious liberty. And there's overarching goals on each team that keeps and binds the team together. And of course, it kind of puts together these different tribal groups that I use the word tribal, but groups that are single issue groups together into a coalition. The left is similar to that, but the left actually has much bigger fault lines than we do on the right. The left actually is much more fractured, and they're only being temporarily plastered together by their hatred of President Donald Trump. This temporary plastering together is going to result in actually the Democrats being in perpetual civil war amongst themselves as soon as Donald Trump is gone. They are nothing more than a Trump referendum party. They have very little guiding principles or philosophy that actually puts them together. And really, the Democrat Party is broken into two different groups right now. It is the political machinists like Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, that just make sure that the Democrat Party exists in power and win elections at all time. And they're very much a pro-corporate Democrat Party, serving the corporate interests of big hospitals or big pharma or big tech companies. And then you have the actual Bolsheviks and the revolutionaries, and they actually should hate each other. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in normal circumstances, would find more resentment because she actually won a primary against a machine politician, basically in New York City, and it was a total surprise. And AOC then becomes one of the most powerful voices in the Democrat Party. And so once Trump is removed from the equation, and this kind of this almost post-traumatic stress disorder that they have every time that you mention Donald Trump's victory, where it's so incredibly visceral to them that they can't even have a conversation around it because they were so certain that the opposite was going to happen. It was almost as if an IED bomb went up next to them. And every time you mention Donald Trump, that they have to go through the same sort of flashbacks to Nam. And so you put this together, I actually think that there's a lot of optimism if the Republican conservative movement and the libertarians within our movement can actually band together on core principles, which is basically just preserving this country. I think that's just a basic uniting facet.
Right.
Knowing why we are here and knowing why we're here, where rights come from. I actually think the right is actually much more united on that than the left. The left actually has a coming civil war. It's not going to happen before the election, but if they lose, it's very possible that the very far left could fracture itself into a 20-30% party, and then the corporate Democrats will be without power. And actually, I think we should encourage this sort of civil war to happen in the Democrat Party.
You know, there used to be, and I can remember growing up, and I still have a few friends that would probably fit into this camp. There was a sliver of Democrats that were pro-life, that were, you know, Christian. Is that a dying, are those dinosaurs now, or do those exist? Are you seeing them at all across the country, or most of them just joining the walk away movement and coming to the right?
Yeah, they're gone, because the only thing that, besides Trump, the only thing that has kept together the Pelosiites, the Schumerites, and the AOCs, and this kind of, and the biggest thing they disagree on, actually, where Pelosi and AOC disagree on, is economics. They actually completely agree on social policy. It's very interesting. So the only thing that keeps AOC and Pelosi on speaking terms is being able to terminate 1 million babies every single year in the womb, and being able to give amnesty to illegal aliens and taking all of our guns away. Like, that's basically what they agree on. As soon as it comes to economic policy, Pelosi understands, in order to keep her in power, she has to please her corporate crony Democrat donors, and AOC and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar have total contempt for that kind of model in that system. There's actually some legitimacy to AOC's criticism of the Democrat leadership. And so there is no place for Christians in the Democrat Party. And if they think there is, they're being lied to. They just want you for power. They take God out of their Pledge of Allegiance. They have constant and total attacks towards religious liberty and freedom. And Joe Biden tries to make a nice posture and says, oh, yeah, I'm a Christian, and therefore Christians should vote for me. Maybe he is a Christian or not. I'm not going to get into that. I'm not one to criticize someone's faith or not. But I will say that everything that he believes in is completely contradictory to the teachings of the gospel, just completely, whether it be the death of the innocent in the womb, whether it be the persecution of those and religious believers, keeping churches closed, the mass proliferation of injustice, and the releasing of prisoners from releasing of prisoners with the complete and total misapplication of fair and impartial law. So anyway, I could go chapter and verse, but for people that are pro-life that used to be in the Democrat Party, they actually call themselves Republicans now.
If I lean back, I can almost see the Golden Dome at the University of Notre Dame outside of my window.
No way.
And I was watching, obviously, the RNC, and you have the comments by Lou Holtz, and we have President Jerry Jenkins here that was very quick to come out and say, hey, Lou Holtz doesn't speak on behalf of the University of Notre Dame, who just hired our former mayor, Pete Buttigieg, who I've interviewed before in the past and those things. I think that some of the statements that, you know, I'm with you. I don't want to question somebody's faith, but when you look at doctrine, that you can't get away from the Catholic Church of what they believe, and that Biden appears to be Catholic in name only.
Yeah, I don't know if you're Catholic or not.
I'm not.
I'm evangelical. However, I'm not criticizing someone's faith. What I will criticize is if you call yourself that and self-describe yourself that, and then you simultaneously endorse certain political positions, I will call that out as doesn't make any sense and foolish and hypocritical. That's what I'm saying.
And look, and if,
your faith. Go ahead.
Well, I was just kidding. You know, if somebody comes to me and says, "Hey, I'm Nietzschean," you know, I don't have any judgment for them.
That means you're a nihilist,
good right? Luck, you believe in nothing. I don't have any judgment for them if they have their, you know, just crazy morals or, you know, whatever. But the moment somebody says, "I'm a Christian and this is what I live by," but yet their list of doctrinal points doesn't line up anything to do, you know, with scripture, that's where I start getting concerned. And I think that there is a right to speak out about.
Yeah, totally and completely. And I find it very hard. And I've, let's just say, caused plenty of chaos in Christian circles by saying this, how any Christian could vote Democrat. I think it's completely antithetical to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, I'm not saying that every Christian should vote Republican. That's what people think I'm saying. I do think it is the better option for Christians. So I'm not equating the gospel with Republicanism. I just think that
I appreciate you clarifying that, because I know that that's something that, you know, I know
that's not the argument
that's been there. Yes,
I do think Christians should support Donald Trump, but I'm not saying that it's a seamless entry. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I do not see how. In fact, I think it is completely and totally backwards and non-fitting at all whatsoever to be a Democrat and a Christian. Choose one, because you can't be both.
No, that's I would agree with that. I think that there's a lot of truth in that. I appreciate the clarification. You know, there for it. So let's talk about, are you willing to talk about your faith a little bit? I know, and first of all, I just want to set this up and saying, I know I've gotten hate mail before, and I can't imagine what your hate mail looks like. And so did you, you know, was developing a thick skin, were you born with this, or does it come over time?
It comes over time. It I actually have deleted all my social media apps from my phone. I have a great team that manages it all for me, which actually helps a lot. So when people are angrily tweeting at me, they think I'm going to see it, and I just won't. So that's actually kind of satisfying. Yeah, look, you get used to it over the years. You get to know who you really are. I started this when I was 18, so I think I've grown up, and I would hope that when I'm doing an interview with you when I'm 30, I hope I would have continued that. I hope I'd more mature and more wise 4 years from now. I hope that doesn't stop. But yeah, look, I mean, when you are in the position that I'm in and you take the stances that I take, which allows me to be in the position that I am, I'm in, you make a couple enemies here and there, but it doesn't bother me. It's just part of the process.
So I'm sure you've had people criticize your faith, question your faith, all of these things. You know, how did you come to faith, and why is your faith important to you in your life?
Yeah, I mean, it's the most important thing in my life. And yes, I've had plenty of people criticize me for that, and they have a right to do that, and I'll pray for them. And that's basically between me and my creator. But look, I've been a Christian basically my whole life. I went to Christian school, 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade. I said the words and accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior when I was in 5th grade, but I didn't quite really understand what it meant. And now, mind you, it means more this year than it did last year. It means more this year than it did when I was 20. So it's almost a gift that grows sweeter with time. The more I read, the more I live, and the more it actually, I completely am able to admit I'm a total absolute sinner and I fall short from the grace of God. And I'm not trying to say I'm a better person than anyone else. And I this is something that bothers me sometimes in Christian circles, is kind of waving the flag of like, I'm the good person club. Like, that's not, I'm saved. And I think we have to get back to kind of what being saved means.
Right.
It means that I was drowning in an ocean. I happened to get picked up by a lifeboat. And that's about it. It's not that I earned it or I swam better than anyone else. And I think that maybe I don't do a good enough job of articulating that it's a confluence of those things. When you live in the world that I live in and you get attacked all the time and you have to come up to a certain standard, you realize that you're really not enough, even close to it. And you have to actually have complete and total surrender to God through his son, Jesus Christ, who is equal God, part of the triad of God. And so, I pray for every single person to be able to find the same sort of redemption and meaning and connection that I have had, I have right now. And so there's a great comfort in actually knowing that you're completely and totally depraved and an awful person, and knowing that you have to accept a savior because of that. It's actually the most comforting thing in the world.
I just got done reading the confession from St. Augustine, and, you know, couldn't agree more. I mean, whether it's Martin Luther, I mean, I, as a pastor myself, you know, I tell people all the time, there's a lot of pastors that claim all these great revelations. My revelation is this: I know how messed up I am. And yeah, that just points me to how good God is and the grace that he has over our lives. And so I think that's important. So let's talk a little bit about this book, because this is so important, I think, especially with November coming up. You know, you wrote about the MAGA doctrine, and obviously Trump is very much at the head of that helm. But I think that in some ways the MAGA doctrine is bigger than Trump. You know, this isn't just a one term thing. I think that there are things in here that we need to get back to. Would you agree to that? You know, that it's bigger than Trump?
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. Look, and that's partly why I wrote the book. I wrote the book for a couple different reasons. First of all, I grew very tired of having people that have never met the president criticize the president professionally on television. Like, you don't know him. Just you've never met him. Stop telling me he's an awful person, okay? Because someone told you that. So that just really bothered me. And so I said, and then that really bothered me. Then a level deeper than that, which really motivated me to write the book, is when people were telling me why he believed what he believed. Like, okay, now you're going toward intentions, not just superficial good and bad. Now you're going to exactly what he's doing. I'm like, okay, now I have to write a book. And so I wrote about the president's biography. I wrote about all of those sorts of things. But more than that, I wrote about the worldview that he was trying to bring into office. And I think there's a lot of wisdom behind it. And I think as time goes on, it's actually more and more people are given permission now to talk about it, especially in like institutional conservative circles, such as maybe it wasn't a good thing for us to just ship over 20 million jobs to China over 10 years. Maybe that did have some victims, and they are victims. Maybe we should make vitamin C in our country. Maybe we should make Tylenol in our country. Maybe it's a good thing that we're making steel again. Like, just really basic things that Trump said instinctively that we are not supposed to say because the corporate class, you know, that was like speech that was policed through the speech police in DC. And if you dare said it, you would kind of just get cast off on an island. So you go crazy radical. Of course, we're going to keep on shipping jobs off seas and enjoy all the plastic you're getting from China. And so Trump did this. And also, I mean, look, I'm a conservative and a Trump supporter, and I'm a Republican after those things. I vote Republican because that's the best option out of all of them. But one thing I completely disagree with in Republican circles is the approach to foreign policy. And I think President Trump's been phenomenal in this regard, which he's been unafraid to eliminate singular entities that pose harm to U.S. allies and our interests. But for the first time in my lifetime, we're not getting into new wars. Yeah. I was born in 1993, and every single president since I've been born has got us into new conflicts, whether it be Bill Clinton in Kosovo, whether it be H.W. Bush right before I was born in the Persian Gulf War, George W. Bush, obviously, in Iraq and Afghanistan, Barack Obama continuing the war in Afghanistan, and also starting new conflicts in both Libya and Syria. President Trump actually has less geopolitical conflicts at the end of his first term than the beginning of his term. And I think that's really interesting. It's the exact opposite of kind of the stereotype that the media puts towards him. They make it seem as if he's some sort of saber-rattling warmonger. I mean, he brought forth peace between the UAE and Israel. That's a pretty incredible accomplishment. He's withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, and he's actually trying to broker peace within the Middle East. So I think that's, for me, I am an endless war critic. I think that the more we have occupied these foreign countries, it's actually bad for us. It's bad for our middle class. And it's really bad for the country we're occupying, actually. I mean, it's bad for how they view America. It's bad for them to get back on their feet. It's bad for them to be self-reliant and self-sustainable. It's a version of failed international colonialism that I think is just so incredibly dated. And if it might serve some corporate interest, but it doesn't serve the interest of our country. And so I wrote this book because I actually think there's five or six really big takeaways from the president's presidency, whether he wins or loses, that I want to see implemented in the Republican Party in the future. And I articulated them in the book. One of them is that Republicans should be unafraid to try to represent all Americans. Despite the stereotype, President Trump delivered more for Black America, despite him getting very few votes from Black America. I think the Republicans have done an awful job of going into the urban communities and inner city America and talking to Black people and saying, hey, we actually represent your viewpoint too, and here's why, and here's five things we stand for. And you might disagree with them, but at least we're talking to you. President Trump spoke at more Black churches in the last 30 days of his campaign than any Republican candidate did in the last 30 years. Wow. And I think that's actually a really cool learning lesson. And so then the other thing is, of course, kind of the anti-hawkishness of our foreign policy, where we don't have to occupy every single country on the planet and actually brings forth more conflict than peace. The restoration of the middle class, I think, is a really big thing. And then the other thing, which is really interesting, and this is where I kind of disagree with Christian. Not only do I disagree, that's a nice way to put it. Christians are so critical of Trump. I say, you understand he's the most socially conservative president when it comes to religious liberty and life that we've ever had. I mean, George W. Bush, who was a Christian, was afraid to talk about the life issue, never talked to the March for Life, never cut Planned Parenthood funding, and we had got John Roberts out of it. So
didn't repeal the Johnson Amendment. All those, list goes
all
on.
All those things.
Yeah.
And so President Trump, and I get that it can be perplexing for certain Christians, and they're like, oh, I don't get it. Like, okay, let me show you a little bit of rope here. I get it. That the three times married, twice divorced, former billionaire playboy from New York fighting for life might be confusing to you. Just go reread Samson in the Bible, and then we could talk about this. I mean, God can use people at all times. We're all sinners. Yeah. We all fall short of the glory of God, all of us. And that's why I don't like getting into this competition of you're a better person, you're a worse person. I mean, if you're an indicted criminal, I think that's something different. But I mean, I think that President Trump and this whole thing, like, oh, he's such a bad person. Like, hold on a second. He's done more to try to save the life of the innocent. He's actually fighting for our country, which I think is so refreshing. So anyway, I actually think that the Republican Party becoming a more socially conservative party is actually how we're going to win. It's the absolute opposite of what the intelligentsia will tell you. They say, oh, get away from social issues. We're going to be socially liberal and fiscally conservative. And yeah, just ask President Romney how that one worked out. I actually think us being the unapologetically pro-life party is how we're going to win the future politically. And this is the most pro-life generation in American history. And I actually think it puts Catholics on defense. And I know you're not Catholic, but you're right near Notre Dame, which I grew up in the Midwest. I know the significance.
I'll get
of
in
Notre
trouble
Dame
for this interview either way. It's fine.
Yeah, whatever. It's fine. But I'll close the point by saying that it's really, really hard if we became the total pro-life party for any Catholic to go straight up against Catholic accepted dogma and doctrine to be, and that's really hard to say, like, oh yeah, I'm going to vote for choice. I'm like, that's your church disagrees with that. And I think that's something that the Catholic Church deserves to be praised for, about how they actually take a definitive stance on life. Not every priest does. Not every local church does as much as others, but I've been to plenty of Catholic churches. My grandma was Catholic growing up, and they did plenty to speak out against abortion. So I actually think we win more votes than lose.
I agree. I mean, I think a lot of the abortion clinics that are out there, the sidewalk counselors that are coming to help out at those places and speak to, I feel like 8 out of 10 times it's somebody that has a Catholic background that's there. And so, I mean, that's a huge part. I hope that continues within Catholic doctrine for years to come. It's very important. So I want to talk some more philosophy if we got some time. So I love that you brought up Hegel. And I think that, you know, what we have today is, you know, you see after Hegel, you have Kant, and you have this sort of synthesis.
The categorical imperative.
Yes. And, you know, you have Kant's ceiling, and basically God's just out there. He's someplace. We can't know him. Yeah. And I see this breakdown. I mean, it's so important, I think. And I geek out on this stuff, and, you know, nobody really wants to pay attention to it, I feel like, most days.
Well, now we're having fun.
Okay. But, you know, it's, you go back and you don't realize, like, how 100 years ago of history, you know, in some cases, you know, more, some cases less, how much it's shaped where we're at today. And people don't realize that they're really just the products of some of these past exactly philosophers. Right.
Yeah, and I think that's one way that Hegel can actually be helpful. And I want to be very clear. I've never read Hegel, but I understand what he theorized, okay? If anyone says they've read The Phenomenology of Spirit, ask them if they've actually read The Phenomenology
right
of Spirit,
yeah,
okay? I have listened to lectures, and I have self-authored essays summarizing Hegel. I have not actually read Hegel. And that, if anyone's actually read it, congratulations. I half believe you, okay? So same goes with Kant, okay? Kant was interesting too, because he tried to actually come up with his own ethical system to replace God. Kant was not anti-God, though. That's what's very interesting. He was fascinated by institutional religion, and he actually was trying to find something to replace it. And so Kant came up with the categorical imperative, which I only bring up for this point, is because the left actually uses the categorical imperative when they want to use it, and then they put the categorical imperative when it comes to their own people. And so just if anyone is wondering what the categorical imperative is, there's two fictional characters that embody the categorical imperative perfect. One is from Les Miserables, which is Inspector Javert, which I cannot tolerate anything bad, because the categorical imperative basically is, if I allow one piece of injustice to go in front of me, then what if that got applied against me? It's as if we can never allow the little smallest thing to happen, and I myself will never indulge in that. And the other one is from Star Trek, Spock. I think Spock actually embraced the categorical imperative, and he was a great personification of it. But the left does this all the time. They say, we live in a constitutional democracy, which we don't. Constitutional democracy, we're really a republic. And the president has broken the law, according to the Constitution, all these things. And then they heavily enforce the Constitution, and they're using that kind of categorical imperative paradigm, like we can't have any injustice for anything, the total and complete dogmatic interpretation of the Constitution. And then the minute that one of their own blatantly violates the law, that doesn't mean anything. So it's, you know, justice. What? So to kind of go to your point, though, yes, these people have really inspired the American left as we know it. And I theorized this, and I got under fire by some professors, and I actually would love to talk to them, because they actually can't really fathom a non-college graduate having a conversation about these things.
But I have an associate degree, so yeah, that's, I'm about the same place with you.
Well, but it means, again, that's an argument from authority. It's just, do you know the stuff or not? I actually draw a direct correlation from Plato to Rousseau to Marx.
Yep.
And I think those three actually leaned on each other the most.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had similarities. They don't believe in private property. They didn't believe in the family. They also believed that through their collective actions, they could create some sort of utopia or philosopher king class. And so I think it's really important for conservatives and for Christians to know the literature that built the society, and also know the literature that's trying to destroy the society around you. And it's also not just those three. I mean, again, I mentioned Hegel, I mentioned Marx, but you can go a level deeper. Go read Michel Foucault. Go read Jacques Derrida from the 1960s and 70s. Those are the two most dark thinkers of the 20th century that have contributed to this postmodern evangelism that we see in our country. And so I'm happy to continue to talk about the philosophical side of it.
I think that you have liberation theology in there, you know, which is basically that there's some sort of spirituality in poverty, and that, you know, I mean, it went as far to, you had people even like Mother Teresa that sort of, you know, there's quotes from basically stating that, who are we to enhance these people's situations too much, because we're robbing from them this grace that's on their life by continuing in this situation. And I think that, you know, there's this real just entanglement that's happened between faith, politics, and you would think that we'd want to come back to scripture and actually see what that has to say. But instead, you know, we're leaning on progressive, you know, and liberal, you know, philosophers over the years, rather than actually trying to reestablish some sort of Christian worldview.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, I completely reject the liberation theologists I mean, it would be nice for them to mention Jesus every once in a while. I mean, I've actually debated a liberation theologist. He didn't mention Jesus the entire time. You're a liberation theology expert, and all you do is you keep mentioning these Catholic, I think they call it a catechism in the Catholic tradition.
Yeah.
They just kept on mentioning this post-scriptural conversations. I was like, can you just get back to the root? Is that important? Or is kind of
well, and even if somebody does mention
some 12th century pope means more.
Even if a leftist does mention Jesus, it's a version of Jesus as a social organizer, you know, rather than the savior of the planet. Savior of the world. You know, and I think that comes out. It's looking at the humanity of Jesus and elevating that over the divinity, or recognizing that he was both fully man and fully God. That's a rejection, because to go there, they have to receive also his moral position.
Yeah. And I think it's very interesting, because people on the left, they will, again, they'll cut and paste, similar to the categorical imperative example, they'll cut and paste the teachings of Christ when it serves them. But when it's the part about protecting the innocent or telling the truth or any of those sorts of things, they want nothing to do with it. And it's very interesting, because these actual teachings go a level deeper than the superficiality of the left. What Christ did civilizationally and geopolitically is he valued people not on their tribal group, but on their direct need to accept God and himself, Jesus Christ, individually. So what does that mean? It's actually a prerequisite on valuing the individual. Go figure that one out. It's not about your tribal group. As Paul says in Philippians, neither slave nor Greek nor free, you're all one under Jesus Christ.
Right.
That's actually kind of where we get the root of the equality under God. And Paul articulates it there. And so we take these things for granted, right? But prior to Christ, people lived in their tribal group. You lived in either the upper middle class in Jerusalem, or you lived in some sort of tribal group in Capernaum. Or, I mean, it's beautifully articulated in the parable of the Good Samaritan. If you're from the wrong side of town, forget about it, right?
Right.
Those divides predated Christ, and Jesus blew up that whole thing in a good way. And then you build a civilization around those ideas where people anywhere across the world of any skin color can succeed and have equal application of the law. I don't think we should take that for granted. It's actually a pretty incredible leap forward, all inspired by the teachings of the Bible, by the way. It's not an insignificant accomplishment. In fact, it's one of the greatest political advancements in human history. And I also find people, they say, well, you know, Jesus Christ would want to help the poor. And I agree, this is where the liberation theologists, I think, get really muddy. I think the best way to help the poor has been making sure, I don't know, have running water and sanitation and medicine and food, that only a market can deliver those things. Forcible coercion actually hurts poor people.
Yeah.
I actually think that the gospel can spread further and brighter and better when you're well fed and you can shower. Go figure. I don't think the liberation theologists, they think there's some sort of grace in being poor. And I'm not trying to say there isn't, but I actually don't think there's any sort of moral argument to be made to try to protect the permanency of the poor. I don't think that's a good argument.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, finance, your money, it exposes what's in your heart. There's no more grace on being poor than there is grace on being rich. You know, if we go to the other extreme of extreme health and wealth gospel, you know, of touch the TV screen, God's going to give you a Lamborghini, you know, and that's the only place where there's blessing is if you have all this nice stuff. That obviously falls into error too. What would you say to the conservative out there who finds himself being drawn into debates and conversations, and how would you encourage them to prepare themselves to really defend the values that you're talking about without falling into the trap of insult culture or conspiracy theory and these sorts of things?
So know your facts and know your stuff. When you get into a conversation, there's a couple rules. Always ask questions. Asking questions is the best way that you can go about trying to achieve commonality, truth. And I want to be very clear. I've kind of been labeled as trying to be like, oh, Charlie always tries to own the libs. Like, I guess that's true. I mean, I guess. There's plenty of videos that show that. And again, I'm plenty happy to cross-examine bad ideas publicly. I'm not ashamed of that. However, most of my dialogues and discussion, 95% of them, the ones that I'm most proud of are the ones where I'm just asking questions and I'm actually putting it in their court, and I'm actually trying to actually extract what they believe into the public arena, so that millions of people can see those kind of collision of ideas made possible. And so I think that's important. I always try to have a lower heart rate than the person I'm talking to. A year from now, when someone watches this interview, and let's just say that they're trying to remember it, they're far more likely to remember what I was wearing or how I was talking than actually what I said. And so it's not an argument to always dress amazingly, but it is an argument that style actually can be more important than substance. And a lot of times people will judge us on tone and on speed of language and conversation. and a lot less on the actual substance of what we're saying. And that's not to say the substance should be lacking. But also, if you're just kind of giving a Benito Mussolini speech as to why Jesus should be king of the world, you're probably going to turn people away, right?
Right.
And so that's how I encourage it. Know your stuff. There is no replacement to being better informed. There isn't. And also, don't ever get involved yourself into personal pejoratives or attacks. When I do that, I regret it, and I do it very rarely.
I think that's great advice, and I think that's a great way to end. Charlie, thanks for going off script with me a little bit here. His new book is called The MAGA Doctrine, The Only Ideas That Will Win the Future. Get it wherever books are sold. Thanks, Charlie, for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Lucas Miles Show on the Edify Podcast Network. For more great podcasts that will build your faith and inspire you, head over to the Apple or the Google Play Store and search for the Edify app. Until next time, it's Lucas Miles.
This podcast is part of the Edify Podcast Network. Edify is a faith-inspiring app that brings together thousands of the best Christian podcasts in one place for your listening enjoyment. Cut through the noise and grow your faith by diving into the world's top Christian podcasts today. Download the Edify app for free from the App Store or Google Play, or by going to edify.app. That's E-D-I-F-I.app.